Welcome back to The Popular Show with me, James A. Smith. This is the podcast about populist politics and apparently Bob Dylan. This is the fourth episode about Bob Dylan that we've contributed since I suggested that we'd start covering more culture and music about a year ago. Somehow the most interesting person at any given moment seems to be Bob Dylan. At the moment, I'm joined by Alison Rapp, who is the assistant editor of Ultimate Classic Rock magazine and a New York-based writer. And she's joining me to discuss Bob Dylan's new release, which is called Shadow Kingdom. Thanks so much for joining us on The Popular Show, Alison Rapp.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Are you well, Alison?
I'm great. I just came back from, I saw Joni Mitchell live in concert for her return to the stage last weekend, so I'm still kind of riding that high. Remind me later, she told a really funny Bob Dylan story. I will have to share that. So okay. things are going well here.
We've got to get that on tape. I first noticed your work when you reviewed the very interesting Elvis Costello concerts that he did at the Gramercy Theatre, is it, in New York City. Maybe you could tell listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was honestly a little bit crazy. I remember going to an Elvis show actually the previous summer and running into one of his PR people and him saying something to the effect of, yeah, Elvis has got this insane idea to do 10 nights of shows and he's already trying to come up with a set list. And I remember thinking at the time that sounds ridiculous. Like only somebody like Elvis could try to pull that off. And lo and behold, I mean, he somehow managed to pull that off. I mean, there's not that many artists who could do, who have the kind of catalog to do 10 nights like that. So yeah, it was
10 notes with no repetition of set list. So he played like 200 songs, right?
Yeah. So he, before the run started, he revealed 10 of the songs from each of the night, and then the other 10 were surprises, and he kind of filled things in along the way. So we had a little bit of an idea of what was going to happen, and he obviously played a number of the hits and the things that people wanted to hear, but this was definitely, I mean, this was deep cut central, really. This was for the hardcore of the hardcore Elvis fans. And it was really, really special. I mean, like I said, there's not that many artists who have the kind of catalog who can work with something like that. So it was really cool to see.
Forgive me. I feel like maybe even just 2 years ago, if you told people that you were the assistant editor of Ultimate Classic Rock magazine, people would sort of regard it as a sort of nerdy eccentricity. But now, since the end of lockdowns, actually these legacy artists are just doing extraordinary things. I mean, there's those Elvis shows, there's all the stuff that Dylan's been doing. We covered the John Cale tour on TPS as well earlier this year, and really it's the legacy artists who seem to have got this crazy lust for life since being prevented from touring for that time. I mean, you've seen Bob, you've seen Elvis, you've seen Joni. What's the sort of overall impression that you've got from those shows recently?
Yeah, I mean, just speaking of Joni, firstly, because that's what's probably freshest in my mind, is that, you know, nobody went to that show expecting her to be in tip-top shape. Nobody went to that show expecting her to sound like she did 40 years ago, 50 years ago, what have you. You really could feel the sense of joy that she felt clearly on stage. I mean, it was very clearly something that you could tell she never expected to be a part of, you know, in the last couple of years. And just the kind of the sense of camaraderie with somebody like Joni working with an artist like Brandi Carlile, who was up on stage with her, and Sarah McLachlan and Marcus Mumford and all of these younger artists who have, you know, in the last couple of years, I think especially since a lot of these legacy artists are unfortunately leaving us, you know, it's kind of this moment where people are, I mean, not to get kind of too dark with it, but giving them their flowers while they're still here with us in these last, you know, couple of decades of their lives. I think that's a really special thing to see. And I totally agree. I mean, I think the lockdown, if anything, just spurred along a sense of creativity for a lot of these artists that they probably wouldn't have found otherwise, or maybe they would have. It just would have looked a lot different. And I think for a lot of these artists, despite having had such long careers, we're in a moment where they were like, man, I've always really wanted to do X, or I've always really wanted to do Y, and now I finally have the opportunity to do it. And the fortunate thing is that a lot of those legacy artists have the funds and the resources to do those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Younger artists don't necessarily always have that, but you know, they can, and that was a moment for them to finally do that. So yeah, I mean, I think people like Dylan and people like Joni, and a number of other people that I've seen in the last couple of years have just taken this opportunity to do the things that they've wanted to do for a very long time.
I feel like taking Dylan specifically, he is in an extremely interesting creative period on his and its own terms. He brought out Rough and Rowdy Ways, this really fantastic and challenging album that we're going to be developing our relationship with for decades to come. He did that at the start of lockdown, as well as the very long experimental track about the assassination of JFK. he did this Shadow Kingdom sort of film music video thing, which has finally come out as a soundtrack album now, and that's what we're discussing. He brought out a book, The Philosophy of Modern Song, and he also embarked on one of the most interesting tours of his career, which in some people's analysis resolves the never-ending tour that began back in the 1980s and begins the new era of the Rough and Rowdy Ways tour. But quite apart from the interest and the creativity and productivity that Dylan is exhibiting in his early 80s, I also think that it's a really interesting moment to be into Dylan because of something more generational in the fan base. I feel like yourself, Laura Tenshirt, who we've had on the show a couple of times, the Joker Men, who I've been listening to for a while, and this whole sort of online fandom of younger people interested in Dylan. I don't know, it feels like you much more than people pushing 40 like me are sort of liberated from the kind of the boomer analysis of Dylan. You know, when I was a teenager, I found out about Bob Dylan and found out about all the trivia from writers in Mojo magazine who had been following him since the 60s. I feel like there's a sort of break with you guys where, I don't know, you've kind of got a different Dylan canon, and you've got a really, you're living through a time when Dylan is a really exciting contemporary artist in a way that hasn't always been true so consistently in the past. Are you sort of cognizant of any kind of generational element in how your interest in Dylan is developing?
You just named several of my favorite people that I have, you know, come to know. And you know, I'll say that pre-pandemic, I was not necessarily involved in that online Dylan community whatsoever. I mean, the pandemic for me myself was something that brought me closer to that community and introduced me to a lot of those people. And I'm grateful for that aspect of it. You know, it's sometimes hard to distill that topic down into, you know, one explanation. But I mean, the shorter answer that I would probably give is that I think for people like myself and a lot of people that you just mentioned, you know, there's something pretty special and there's something pretty unique about having grown up with Dylan's entire catalog pretty much at the touch of a button. Yeah. So, you know, for my whole life, I've had access to pretty much everything, which I think is what sets, you know, us apart in a generational aspect from a lot of those people who were growing up having to wait for the next record and having to see what comes next. The great part about that, at least in my opinion, is that, you know, myself and those other people have kind of been able to sort of chart our own path through Dylan's catalog, and we don't have to work chronologically necessarily. I mean, I can remember, you know, growing up, my dad was a Dylan fan, and he is obviously of the generation that grew up with, you know, his older brothers passing down records and a lot of those records like coming out one by one and waiting for the next one and waiting for the next one and seeing what Dylan would turn into next and never really knowing. And for myself, you know, I grew up and he would play things like Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61, and then in the next hour switch to something like Modern Times. And there's a huge, huge gap between those two records, you know, creatively, artistically, I mean, chronologically. And so when you flip-flop back and forth between things like that so frequently, I mean, it just gives you a different perspective on what Dylan's kind of what the arch of his career rather has looked like. And so I think for myself, I've found that to be a really beneficial way to kind of go through Dylan's catalog and learn it and identify with different parts of it.
And that allows you, I suppose, to break free slightly from the what we might call boomer temporality of this kind of, you know, classic rock. And by that I mean everything was great in the 60s and proceeded to get slightly less great as time went on. By contrast, I mean, you're getting into Dylan when you have, you've also had the releases of very major bootleg series,
right,
reassessments of some of the more unloved parts of the Dylan canon. Yeah. So in that, you know, boomer version of Dylan history, the Christian period is not good. The 80s is not good. And Time Out of Mind is good, but it not in the way that we kind of consume it in fragments, as this, yeah, the recent release Fragments, which we covered with Laura Tensho. It's this extraordinary deep dive of you know, many versions of the same song from that 1997 album. So in a way, your Dylan is slightly more kind of backloaded. And this is true of Joker Men, who their whole kind of premise was they started with John Wesley Harding. They started after the kind of big canonical 60s period and went from there. Laura recently mentioned that on her show, Definitely Dylan, she realized that in the podcast form, she'd never done anything on the 60s Dylan at all until now. I mean, this might be a way of sort of bridging into Shadow Kingdom, which is subtitled The Early Songs of Bob Dylan. I'm kind of interested in this record insofar as it's Dylan now returning, re-recording old songs, going back to the 60s. Is there in some way a kind of on-ramp for revisiting the 60s stuff, which quite a lot of the big reassessment and big generational reassessment of Dylan has actually been surprisingly uninterested in compared to the later stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I can remember, obviously it was quite purposeful when they announced the Shadow Kingdom dates that they, you know, they didn't want to reveal too much about what that actually meant, about what the earlier songs was going to include. And the ironic thing about Dylan, of course, is that when you say the earlier songs of Bob Dylan, that could mean a whole bunch of things. You know, I mean, I didn't necessarily expect it to be everything from 1960 to 65 or something like that. I think, though, that, you know, I can't imagine Dylan, I just can't imagine him doing something apart from that. I can't imagine him revisiting those songs in a way that wouldn't, both in a way stay true to what he had originally written and what he had originally arranged, but also at the same time, you know, completely revamping something in a way that nobody had really, you know, purposely keeping that very shrouded and very mysterious. I, in a way, almost sort of expect him to sort of maybe work his way through that catalog a little bit more and maybe do like a Shadow Kingdom sort of thing part two with, like you said, maybe the 80s material, some kind of, you know, like Slow Train Coming, like revamped version of something like that. But I think that, you know, to do that kind of work in the middle of the pandemic when a lot of people were already doing some retrospective thinking and sort of looking back towards what they had already produced and what they were moving toward was, you know, a smart move, really.
Yeah, and it's not something he's ever particularly done. I mean, the bootleg series collection is other people have sort of emulated it, but no one's been able to do that real excavation in public of their past. But so he's sort of done it at arm's length in that way, shown the kind of working out and shown the alternative versions from the time in each case of the whole range of his career. But as far as committing to record, it's quite striking. I mean, there's no live album since the 1980s, despite the recording of the famous Supper Club sessions in the early 90s, which was supposed to be a live album and never came out. So unless you've seen Dylan live a lot, this is a huge kind of part of his hinterland and a huge part of his canon that most people just don't get to hear. The revisiting, the changing, the rearranging of the whole kind of history on stage. And so this is almost like finally we get that kind of door creaked open in public. Mm-hmm. The fact that he never does it on tape, but a huge part of what he does day to day, more than any artist, is rework the earlier material.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I was just thinking, like, anyone who's gone to a Dylan show is quite familiar with this modus operandi for sure. But, you know, I'd like to think that somebody who hears Shadow Kingdom, who maybe isn't necessarily, who has never seen Dylan live or has never really taken the time to kind of like dive into that section of his career, the live aspect of it, might think, okay, I sort of understand what's happening here. And the other thing too that I was thinking, you know, when I was listening to it again, is that, you know, one of the most common complaints that people who see Dylan live, that sort of boomer generation, I don't mean to put it in such a blanket term, but, you know, one of the most common complaints that they have is that they can't understand what Dylan is saying, and they can't understand what he's singing, and his enunciation is not clear. And I mean, Shadow Kingdom, to me at least, is the complete opposite of that. I mean, it could not be clearer. And so this might be a little bit of a gateway into that world for some people who didn't, quote unquote, get it before. Yeah.
Well, should we dive in? Should we try and sort of take this track by track? So it opens with When I Paint My Masterpiece. The first four tracks actually are early songs of Bob Dylan that he would, after this, incorporate into the set list, which remained largely unchanged since the end of the pandemic, through American, European, Japanese, and now back to European tours. When I Paint My Masterpiece, Most Likely You'll Go Your Way, and I'll Go Mine, and I'll Be Your Baby Tonight, tracks 1, 2, and 4, all went into that set list. It's an interesting opener, When I Paint My Masterpiece, because like Watching the River Flow, it is not quite a canonical track. It never appeared on an album. It was almost like we're kind of used to people doing this today. It's almost like a bonus track on a best of, the best of that was released in the early 70s.
Oh, the streets of Rome are filled with rubble. Ancient footprints are everywhere.
I should probably preface my thoughts on a lot of these tracks. I mean, it's difficult to believe the film came out 2 years ago now. I mean, that just seems like a complete lifetime ago, and Dylan has done so much since then. But I should probably preface it by saying that when I first watched all that, I was in the middle of, I had just moved to a brand new apartment here in New York. I was sitting amongst stacks of boxes, and about 3 or 4 days prior, I had just had all four of my wisdom teeth removed. So I was on Percocet while I was watching this. And
so I was completely, strange times.
Yeah, I mean, that might have tainted my opinion of it slightly. But, you know, I think that I've had a very different experience now listening to this record as an album, as opposed to watching it as a film. And now having kind of, you know, separated the visual from the audio in a really clear way has completely kind of changed my perspective on the arc of these songs and the selections and all of that. Because obviously when you're watching the film, there's so much to look at. It's weird. There's a lot going on. And it completely, you know, takes your attention up. And I don't think I even remember paying that much attention exactly to the first song, because I was so concerned about what was going on screen. And I have to be honest, I don't know that I love this as an opening track. I don't know that I would call it weak per se, or I don't know that if it's not strong, but it doesn't necessarily grab my attention the way that I would hope that a Dylan opener might. And again, I think that the film is very different because I was so enamored with what I was seeing on screen that I wasn't paying as much attention to the audio. But now I just feel like it's a slightly kind of weak-ish start. I'm not even necessarily saying that that is a full-blown criticism or a bad thing per se. But that's my opinion. Yeah. But of course, the first thing that I noticed right off the bat is obviously his vocal sounds fabulous. I mean, his voice live and on record in the last couple of years has just been really phenomenal.
This is often attributed to his spell recording, basically four discs of covers of Frank Sinatra. Around what are we talking, 2013 to 15, where this seems like a kind of eccentric thing to have done, but he's done so much since then. That's often been framed as one of these kind of recuperations that Dylan undergoes, mm-hmm. where he soaks himself in the work that's inspired him and then returns with a different voice, a different insight. And it struck me that here's Dylan committing to record a set of cover versions of his own material. And it's actually a very similar project to those Sinatra covers projects where he's sort of saying, no, I can actually sing this. Well, showgoers are so used to great vocal performances from Dylan in recent decades, but also weird ones and insular ones and very, very croaky ones. For this instrument to turn up in the early 2020s is a really striking thing. To defend the choice as an opener for a second, I guess there's a nice sort of mock grandiosity, the opening of an epic poem, invoking the muse to inspire you to sing. And here we have the song, waiting for when I'm going to write this masterpiece. It was already kind of cute in the early 70s when Dylan first sang it and had a decade, an unprecedented career in pop music already. For him to be still waiting for that masterpiece in his early 80s has a nice humor to it, I guess. and it also sets up an ambiguity that's going to run through some of the tracks in the record where we've got a lot of lyrical changes. And in the sort of world of, Dylan commentary and Dylan writers, there's a phrase, I think it comes from Dylan himself, which is dummy lyrics. Like if he's just working out a song or if he's just trying to entertain himself on stage, he'll kind of freestyle lyrics. And the ambiguity there is like, which are the dummy lyrics where he's just making it up off the top of his head, and which are the considered artistic creative rewrites that we need to take notice of as this new kind of statement or alternate version? I would hazard that actually it's impossible to tell the difference, and the dummy lyrics aren't so dummy, and the great reimaginings that have marked so much of his life career also have a kind of improvisatory, playful kind of dimension to it. So I also appreciate the idea that whatever it was, 1971, when he wrote When I Write My Masterpiece, the fact that it's still being rewritten live and has been in the interim and is even at the start of this record, there's some satisfaction to that for me also.
Yeah, completely. I remember being pretty engrossed by that kind of idea when they opened the Bob Dylan Center last year. I went to the opening weekend, and there was one particular section where they had the notebooks from the lyrics that he was writing for Blood on the Tracks, and he just had pages and pages and pages of all of these different, there were hundreds really of like alternative lyrics, alternative versions of these songs, and it was just it's even more mind-blowing when you kind of see it in person. You see the physical, like, actual handwritten out changes like that. But,
Do you want to go to Most Likely You'll Go Your Way and I'll Go Mine? This is the one sort of canonical 60s song that people who went to the Rough and Rowdy Ways shows will have seen. The only song is from Blonde on Blonde, so the only song from that kind of great trilogy, and also the earliest song in the live set list, and it's in the same position on Shadow Kingdom as track two.
I'm going to sound a little bit critical again, but the first like two tracks, I think for me, are just slightly funky to me, and for mm-hmm. me at least, I don't really settle into this record, I think, until at least Queen Jane, probably the next song. Yeah. I don't know how subjective of an opinion that is necessarily, because I have talked to some other people who have a similar viewpoint to that. I think even, you know, before he moves into the song, I think the thing that I noticed off the bat, of course, was these very kind of ethereal sounding, funky, almost transitions between the songs.
Oh yeah.
That in and of itself, to me, I, again, hadn't necessarily picked up on as clearly when I was watching the film. And I know I said earlier that now listening to this as an album is an entirely different experience than watching that film, but having those transitions in between definitely gives it that sense of narrative and that sense of arc that I hadn't really fully noticed before. It gives it that kind of theatrical, almost cinematic sort of quality without having any of the visuals, you know, even there. Like you can almost picture the artist sort of like resetting themselves up for the next song. I gotta be honest, I cannot decide if I love the riff in this song or I hate the riff in this
Okay.
song.
I think this
I
is important.
Go back and forth.
I
it's
think
just, it's aggressive to me, and I don't know. It's just something about it kind of rubs me the wrong way. I can't put my finger on it.
Okay, so you're not blown away by it here on Shadow Kingdom, and this is a great kind of introductory example of the string band arrangements that yeah. we have on Shadow Kingdom. No drums, incidentally, and the dong 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 da dong dong is just on the double bass. So it's kind of a subtle one. Okay, you're not blown away by it here. What about in the live shows that you saw when it had the same position? He opens with Watching the River Flow, and song two is Most Likely You'll Go Your Way, I'll Go Mine. Did you feel differently on stage?
I think that would be true for pretty much any Dylan song. It does always come across to me differently. I think mostly because I'm paying the majority of my attention towards his, you know, his phrasing and his delivery and that kind of thing, and how it matches up against that riff.
Yeah.
Whereas when it's on the record, and the other thing too about this record is that it's, you know, it's well mixed. It sounds really great. And I just feel like it comes across a little bit more harsh on record than I would for it to sound. But again, that's a very subjective.
What I loved about it on stage, and it's either toned down here, or he hadn't managed to be live on stage with it for a while, or in this incarnation, so it hadn't taken its full form. This is a good example of, like, we're now going back to the nascent versions of songs that will have a big kind of afterlife in the live show. And I think this is a great example because it's that sort of subtle bass riff here, but on stage, that down, 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 down was like so bizarre. And yeah. I've said circus-like before, and I think I'm getting that from The Judge Who Walks on Stilts in the lyrics. I'll ask you about what shows you saw at some point in this conversation, but I saw him at the second night at the London Palladium, which was the night when one of the guitarists, I'm not such a nerd that I know their names, wasn't there. And so his, like, at times atonal modernist piano playing was even more accentuated. And this song felt like it was going to topple off the stilts the whole way it was playing. And that riff would occasionally just sort of blast in to kind of bring back the coherence to it. And it was just wonderful seeing this work happen on stage. I've got a lot of affection for the Shadow Kingdom arrangement of Most Likely on the basis of what I saw on stage subsequently. You may be right, though, that this is a record that's still pulling its punches before it gets to track three, Queen Jane.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, this is kind of where I start to settle in to the album and where things kind of start to hit its stride, at least, you know, for me. And you know, I've now listened to the album. I've listened to it on good speakers. I've listened to it in considerably less good, like, wireless earbuds. I mean, I've heard it in a few different ways now. And this, to me, is just kind of where things kind of smooth out. You kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but this is one of the first songs where I feel like that sense of, you know, there's a certain sense of wisdom and wistfulness to a lot of these songs that now Dylan, singing these songs at the age of 81, or, you know, however old he was when he was recording these tracks, you know, it just places a much heavier weight on these songs than the original versions, of course. You know, all of your children start to resent you, a line like that delivered now versus when that was first recorded. I mean, that's an entirely different line to say. And I also, you know, so many of these lines, I think Bob Dylan is probably the king of phrasing, and the way he delivers some of these lines is just absolutely, it's weird. He's very weird about certain things. He'll delay certain lines. Some things sound so much more syncopated than they, you know, ever have before. He catches you off guard with certain words. And I think that is really on full display, not necessarily even just in this song, but throughout the whole record. That's something that he has a tendency to do in his live shows. And it comes across really, really palpably in this album in particular, I think. This, to me, sounds as close kind of to a live Dylan performance on record that you're going to get, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Something clicks in the record with Queen Jane approximately for me as well. I think the part of the experience of listening to this has been, hearing the older Dylan go back to these songs, which are just so familiar to me at this point. I've been listening to this stuff since, you know, I was 15 or so. And it's just very interesting to see one's relationship with an artist and one's relationship with an individual recording kind of unfolding. Queen Jane approximately, I always see as a kind of keeper song, because when I was a teenager, one of my dad's friends, who was, you know, everyone's got this kind of guy in their family milieu who was the guy who came around and would get drunk, and he's the one who I would talk to about music and learn about music from. And he associated Queen Jane approximately with Lou Reed, Velvet Underground, Sweet Jane. And he would say, I got this friend, and I've got these two songs for her that I always think about her with. And so, I don't know, that's always stayed with me as an example of how, you know, life gets complex and messy, and you get all this sort of stuff and feeling piled on you over the years, and songs can just be a sort of constant through that. And so even before I'd ever, you know, known anyone well enough to have such, you know, baggage with or complicated feelings about or musical associations with, I already sort of saw this as an example of the kind of song that you end up associating with a person. I think that was sort of part of the inauguration into taking some pop, you know, kinds of pop music seriously on that basis. But it is a hell of a song, and that's another thing that this record invites us to realize, even before we get to some of the examples where Dylan clearly, by the arrangement, really wants us to revisit the lyrics. I mean, you know, you talk about that that stuff about the children starting to resent you. I mean, what strikes me here is the second verse. Now, when all of the flower ladies want back what they have lent you, and the smell of their roses does not remain, that sort of theme of provisionality and how everything could be taken away from you. You know, where what is it? When you think you've lost everything, you can always lose a little more, as we heard on Fragments. That sort of provisional glory, which it's only now I sort of realize is the theme of Like a Rolling Stone, and also a song that appears here, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. Everything is temporary, like Achilles. why was he so preoccupied with that at that early stage? And why is it communicated so beautifully here in a song that he wrote in his mid-20s?
Right, completely. I mean, I think that probably obviously terrified a number of people when those songs were first coming out. Mm-hmm. Of course, and you know, that just reminds me, like you say, that's a theme that continues to run through his music. I think of the lyric "I sleep with life and death in the same bed" from Broadway's, and that whole theme of just, you know, success and failure always being just one step away from one another, and fate having a lot to do with it, and luck having a lot to do with it. I don't know that anybody quite articulates that theme quite as well as Dylan has, especially given, you know, articulating it from the perspective of the 20-year-old, the 30-year-old, the 40-year-old, an 80-year-old.
Yeah. I learn from Paul Williams, famous trilogy on Bob Dylan as performing artist, that he didn't actually start playing this live until the 1980s. So presumably this is and that was only at the prompting of the Grateful Dead when he toured with them. They were the ones who insisted that this was a song he should be playing live. Presumably he wrote it in the 60s and then just didn't pay a thought to it until he was trying to, you know, work out how to be a live artist again.
When your mother sends back all your invitation, and your father, your sister,
you could do an entire podcast episode on songs like that, songs that you know, Dylan for one reason or another set aside, and then for whatever reason something happened, something changed that prompted him to bring that back.
I'll Be Your Baby Tonight.
I can't remember if I've heard this one live in the set list that, you know, in the shows that I've been to.
I'll hazard that you will have done.
I would imagine so.
Yeah, I think you must have seen the same set list. This is a good point. Tell us about the Dylan shows that you've seen.
Yeah, so the first time I saw Dylan would have been, that was 2017 when Mavis Staples was the U.S. opener, that run of shows. And I saw him in a pretty big, you know, kind of Coliseum style venue, and went by myself, and it was, you know, it was an enlightening experience, and it was unlike anything I'd ever seen.
Just like the cinema, you have to go to see Bob Dylan on your own.
Exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. It's a very personal experience. So that was the first time. And I was a lot closer than I thought I was going to be. And it it changed everything, not to be too cliche about it. And then the next two times that I saw him would have been both at the Beacon Theater here in New York, which is where he always makes his usual Thanksgiving week run. He did not do that last year, presumably because he was busy elsewhere. But I've seen him twice there as well. And that setting is always a real treat because, you know, you can tell he loves the venue and he just kind of loves having that proximity to the audience. It's beautiful. So those are the three shows that I've been to so far. Obviously, I would hope to see some more, but we'll see.
So I missed the date on those last shows.
Were
those Rough and Rowdy?
The first time at the Beacon Theater would have been 2019.
Ah, so this is all pre-pandemic.
That was pre-pandemic. Yeah. And then the second time would have been the last time that he was in town, which would have been 2021, I guess. Because that would have been, you know, right after pandemic restrictions had lifted. It's always interesting to me because, you know, I think some people hear me say those dates or mention those years and they think, oh, well, like, what do you know? You've only seen him a couple of times and it's been within the last, you know, 5 years. Like, it really, you haven't fully experienced that part of Dylan's live career. But I think the last 5 to 10 years, especially for Dylan in terms of a live setting, has been, you know, it's changed a lot of people's perspective on Dylan overall. So I'm glad.
It's been a lot of people's idea of an entire career, what he's done in that period, for sure. Well, yeah, I mean, I'll Be Your Baby Tonight. It is a very popular song, and it's been a staple of his tours for a long time. And it's one of the sort of weird, like, load-bearing walls in the set where he plays the entirety of Rough and Rowdy Ways. And he plays a sort of cluster of songs, and a few others have this sort of same arrangement where he does some verses with just a sort of single chord and kind of recites the lyrics.
I said, I'll be your baby tonight.
And then this, like, Pulp Fiction kind of surf riff comes in. I mean, he was obviously having a good time when I saw him at the London Palladium, because he said afterwards, "That song's for all of the baby fans. I'm a baby fan too."
You were at that show?
I was at Baby Fan. Yes.
That made me laugh for days, I have to be honest with you. I mean, it was really, who else would say something like that?
It was cute, of course. But it's also an example of Dylan's fidelity to that kind of turn of end of the 60s, start of the 70s. It's represented by Masterpiece, is represented by Watching the River Flow, it's represented by To Be Alone With You, which we'll get to, and it's represented by I'll Be Your Baby Tonight. All of these are minor works, and, you know, some of them were avowedly Dylan kind of casting off his counterculture reputation and writing straight country songs, this and To Be Alone With You, that applies to. But he seems to always go back to them as some kind of moment of transition or moment of gathering strength, or he finds them somehow useful in a live context to interrupt the more sort of challenging and forbidding works that he wants to perform. And so it's just nice to have another version of it on tape, really, with the Shadow Kingdom one.
Yeah, I don't know that there can be too many versions of a song like that necessarily. Mm-hmm. I mean, that then is the mark of, you know, there are a few different marks of good pop songs, and that, I think, is one of them, the ability to be manipulated that many times over.
Yeah, for sure. Next up is, we're returning to the same record that Queen Jane is from, Highway 61 Revisited, which is Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues. This is another of those kind of forbidding, knotted, difficult poems that you could see how a guy like A.J. Weatherman would sort of get drawn into this kind of paranoid obsession with interpreting what the secret meaning behind every lyric of Dylan was. And for me, these are great works of postmodernism up there with Warhol or anybody in the 60s. And yes, it's exhilarating to find Dylan he's an actor at this stage, re-performing or revising this great role that he played back then.
Yeah. I mentioned this at the beginning, it has this very theatrical kind of feeling to it. And I even say that too as somebody who has now seen Girl from the North Country twice, has kind of seen how like some of these songs that were by no means written for the stage or written for the production in any sort of way, can kind of fit into a theatrical narrative without even necessarily changing all of the words. This to me, I mean, this is one of my favorite Dylan songs, probably, if I had to make a list. And I think this one in particular, the vocal on, is really lovely. And this is another one where the phrasing in it and the way he sort of delivers some of these lines is really weird and really interesting and keeps you on your toes. Dylan has this habit, and it's funny too, I'm gonna criticize Elvis Costello a little bit in this, but Dylan has this habit, especially live, and he does it a little bit on this record, of kind of doing this sort of like delayed delivery with some of these lines, where he'll sort of like wait, where he's just like on the end of the beat or even a little bit late to the beat. And when he does it live, it's really cool, and it's powerful, and like you can tell he's totally in charge of what he's doing and the song that he's singing. Elvis tries to do that a little bit, and he tries to do that a bit in he did a lot of it at the Gramercy, and he's been doing it more and more in his live shows that I've noticed. The thing about Elvis's music is that doesn't always necessarily fit. The songs don't necessarily ask for that, or they don't always hold that kind of delivery as well as some of Dylan's songs do. And I don't mean to criticize Elvis so harshly, but sometimes the way that he tries to kind of deliver those lines, it ends up making him, it makes it seem a little bit messier than I think maybe he's intending for it to sound. And it makes the band seem a little bit messier than it's intending to sound. But anyway, the point just being that Dylan does that pretty frequently in his live shows, and I hear him doing it here, and usually doing something like that, translating something that's very good live onto a record in that way, doesn't always come across maybe the way that you want it to, but it works. It works here.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I respect Elvis Costello for is that it doesn't matter how sick he is and how fucked up his voice is, he always does it. There is footage of him with mumps singing. There is footage of him with George Jones, and he's obviously got like the worst flu in the world. But
I gotta respect him for that.
I'm turning up. It's George Jones, and I, when you were seeing those Gramercy shows, I was fascinated by this idea that he was just playing song after song with no repetition. And so I was kind of following along on YouTube, and yeah, he sounded terrible in some of those shows, but he was turning up and he was doing it. The voice must be in the room in whatever condition or whatever it wants to do in that instance. And this was a great one to revisit again. What it reminds me of is the fact that the 60 songs of Dylan are young men's songs, and I somehow realize now that I've always thought of them that way. When I was first so kind of fascinated by them and obsessed with them, I was conscious of being too young to have experienced the feelings of them, and now I see a kind of wonderful immaturity in them, and I don't know. I mean, we can. It's easy to sort of reel off the the sort of misogynistic tinges of Dylan's songs in the 60s from, you know, It Ain't Me, Babe, which is really the same song as All I Really Want to Do Is Be Friends With You. That's like him trying to be nicer about it. Positively Fourth Street. The sort of contempt at being loved in the way that you didn't want to be loved. That seemed like eerily mature to me when I first listened to it, and now seems sort of babyish, and couldn't you have just been nicer about it?
it's funny how that changes over time.
It's funny how it changes over time, yeah. But, I mean, examples here, there's so much that, like, invites over-interpretation. Whenever Dylan's sort of just saying place names and figures from literature and history, I think don't over-interpret that. It's about the vibes. It's about the atmosphere, and it's about this kind of screen print effect, postmodern screen print effect that he's trying to create. What's interesting is always the relationship stuff. And here it's this very young man thing of being conscious of being somehow feminized by being desired. They've got some hungry women there, and they really make a mess out of you. That has the worldly wisdom of the guy who's been through it, telling another guy who's been through it, but who's still young enough and kind of feminine and beautiful enough to have experienced the hunger of these hungry women who are there. And I mean, similarly, this beautiful anecdote about Sweet Melinda, where you're so kind and careful not to go to her too soon, and she takes your voice and leaves you howling at the moon. That mixture of it's totally unclear whether it's she who kind of ravages the guy who was trying to so carefully approach the seduction, or whether, you know, he gets nothing from her, but she takes his voice, nice meta thing, as it's a song, and howling at the moon, well, the moon is virginity. No, I didn't get her. these sort of snapshots of sexual awkwardness and sexual arrogance, which is also completely awkward as well. That's one of the things I find comes to life when it's the old guy singing the young man's words.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if Dylan is anything, it's a man of contradictions. And I mean, what contradicts better than that? I mean, I think that is what makes him more relatable to people, not less.
He's got a bit of a set piece going here, because he goes straight from, and it's one of those examples of what you describe of that kind of noodling guitar that transitions from one song to the other. Goes straight from Just Like Tom Thumb Blues to Tombstone Blues, the two songs that address themselves as blues songs on, again, Highway 61 Revisited. And this is one of the more striking kind of departures of arrangement.
Completely. You know, particularly that first like minute or so of the song, the transition from Tom's Thumbs to Tombstone Blues is very sinister sounding, the way it kind of swells and recedes almost. It's very, you know, mysterious. I love the chord changes there. I think those are beautiful. But you're right, this is probably one of the biggest departures from the original arrangement on the whole record. And again, I think it, you know, I can hear a lot of that work with the Frank Sinatra songs kind of coming through it in this piece in particular, the way that he's delivering some of those lines and delaying some of them. And, you know, I hear some of Rough and Rowdy Ways in it as well. I kind of hear this mixture of the last
three or four. That recitation thing of Rough and Rowdy Ways, where you just get the simplest chord or musical statement and then the voice is on its own.
The hysterical bride in the penny arcade, screamy cheap boots have just been made. Sends for the doctor who pulled down the shade, saying my advice is not to let the boys in.
And that is, you know, not at all how the original arrangement makes you think or makes you feel at all. So, I mean, this might be one of my favorites on the record.
Another sort of way at it might be to think of the Johnny Cash American recordings. which Dylan is slightly contemptuous of in The Philosophy of Modern Song, which I was one of those moments where I felt kind of seen, because I always loved those records so much, and read Dylan sort of saying, Cash used to be funny, and now he just does this kind of dead old man routine on the American recordings, and I sort of felt a little seen there. It's a bit cheap of Dylan to do that after Cash is dead, but I thought, oh no, maybe he's right actually. But the comparison would be on those Cash records. Rick Rubin created this just absolutely pure production of just beautiful acoustic instruments, or even when it was Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers,
right,
beautifully clear electric instruments, which are this utterly modest and innocuous held back background to the voice, which is totally trusted. And I think there's something of that here, where the whole point was, as Dylan said in the Manchester Free Trade Hall, play it fucking loud. The whole point of Dylan going electric was you had the most raucous, fucked up garage rock, more Stones than the Stones electric sound. And he was off his face drawling this incredible inspiration poetry over the top of it. It's only now that we can get the kind of the respect for professional musicians who step back, and he will present the words to us, and it's a wonderful, again, it is a wonderful poem, Tombstone Blues. If stitched through so many of those songs of the 60s, including the ones on here, we get this really interesting, pretty much unique actually, articulation of the trials of the fuckboy. Here we step away from that, and what we instead get is a brilliant portrait of paranoia, but it's not as a strung out artist of a later decade might. It's not approached in that way, where it's me who's so paranoid. Mm. Here, it's this brilliant kind of recognition of paranoia in others. The city fathers, they're trying to endorse the reincarnation of Paul Revere's horse. The town has no need to be nervous. It reminds me of Jonathan Swift and Gulliver in Lilliput, this idea that, seen from the outside, the kind of political neuroses and worries of this group of people seem completely diminutive and tiny and preposterous. And then that magnificent couple of verses, which we're taken back to, John the Baptist, after torturing a thief, looks up at his hero, the commander-in-chief, saying, "Tell me, great hero, but please make it brief. Is there a hole for me to get sick in?" This idea of, you know, you've committed this act of state violence, you're looking at the commander-in-chief for approval, and you very politely announce that you need to vomit because of what the institutions forced you to do. The commander-in-chief answers while chasing a fly of death to all those who would whimper and cry, and dropping a barbell, he points to the sky, saying, "The sun's not yellow, it's chicken." I mean, that's a beautiful, cheap joke. It makes me think of Kubrick and the Dr. Strangelove, the general there talking about his vital fluids being drained by the enemy. This paranoia, this obsession with, you know, violence everywhere, and the human effect, the debilitating human effect of that. It's as great a satire on the state as any of those actual protest songs that he was doing just a few years earlier. It's another Masters of War, really, which I wouldn't have realized without this slowed down, enunciated, vocal led version.
Right. No, I was just going to add, yeah, when that story is juxtaposed with that kind of arrangement, it changes everything about it. Yeah. And it, which is remarkable given that, you know, there are no lyrical changes in that. There's nothing different aside from the arrangement. That contradiction is what makes that song so much different.
By lyrical changes, you're taking us into To Be Alone With You, which is the next track, and just gives us this wonderful treat, and it's so good live as well, to be alone with you, you know, everyone knows, to be alone with you, just you and me. Now it's the ungrammatical and completely surprising, just you and I, which begins a totally revised set of rhymes thereafter.
I mean, this is the song, I have a note written down here when I was listening to it last. This is the song that evidently made me think most significantly why he ended up choosing some of these selections. I'm not sure exactly why. You know, these are just, these are pieces that you have to wonder, like, what he maybe didn't find quite right with the original version, or didn't feel like he had fully hit the nail on the head with. Of course, that could also, you know, not be accurate at all. He could feel entirely good about the way that these songs were originally recorded, and it has nothing to do with that instead. But I think that, you know, I mean, to put it kind of simplistically, I think Dylan gets kind of bored, and who wouldn't when you're 80 years old and you've been doing these same songs for as long as you have. You know, I also have a note written down here. I love how he delivers the line, "What happened to me, darling," where he kind of like draws out, you know, it's that is probably the best example on the record, or at least thus far, where it feels very much like Dylan is the actor in this play.
Yeah, definitely. It's a track from Nashville Skyline, the second going electric, as it were. You know, he pissed off the folk fans by going by starting to play rock music. He pissed off the rock fans, the counterculture, everyone who was so invested in what he represented, by turning to this right-wing genre of country music and does it better than anyone. And yeah, to be alone with you is quite deliberately a completely apolitical, unprogressive pop song. And that is its statement. What he does here is turn it back into a Dylan song. You know, mm-hmm. all these decades later, what was it again about darling? That's one of the new lyrics.
What happened to me, darling?
What happened to me, darling? That's a very good example of the subtle complication that he deliberately drove out of his writing on Nashville Skyline. And it's there, you know, with that beautiful line, "I'll hound you to death, that's what I'll do." You know, the reserve of this kind of, I'm going to try and be a manufactured Nashville country writer on this album, the reserve that he showed at that point in the late 60s is released. And now a song that is no less a song of desire, joyous eroticism, and so on, it's far more powerful articulation in just the brilliant way that Dylan has of writing about those themes. And it wasn't even over. If I would recommend listeners get on YouTube and hear the performances of this in Japan and Madrid, and it was even a very different beast when I saw it a couple of times in the UK. It just kept growing, and this new violin riff, fiddle riff comes in to it that isn't there on Shadow Kingdom. It's as you say, this sense of unfinished business in the original recording that has only actually continued since the Shadow Kingdom one. Look, we've hit the hour. If you're happy to stick around with me, Alison, I'm going to say goodbye to the freeloaders. And, you know, if you followed this far, then you're obviously sick enough to want to hear about the rest of the record. So I'm going to say get over to patreon.com/thepopularpod, where you'll be supporting independent media. You know, who could do this on the big platforms? You'll also be hearing from the wonderful Alison Rapp about the rest of this record.